Good evening. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Not yet.
Not yet? Okay. Okay, we're trying to labor long and hard to figure out where we left off, who we are, what we're doing here. And we decided, we may be wrong about this, but this is where we're going to start on page 18, Roman numeral 18, right in the middle of the page, and I'll start reading, and we'll just read until we figure out what we're going to say. In the spring of 1940, Dr. John D. Rockefeller, now this would be obviously the foreword to the second edition. In the spring of 1940, John D. Rockefeller, Jr. gave a dinner for many of his friends to which he invited AA members to tell their stories. News of this got on the world wires, inquiries poured in again, and many people went to the bookstores to get the book Alcoholics Anonymous. By March of 1941, the membership had shot up to 2,000. Then Jack Alexander wrote a feature article in the Saturday Evening Post and placed a compelling picture of AA before the general public that alcoholics in need of help really deluged us. By the close of 1941, AA numbered 8,000 members. The mushrooming process was in full swing. AA had become a national institution. And, you know, I started laughing when I read this. The only thing I have to say about this paragraph, it just brings to mind, I don't know how many of you all know about this. This was when Bill Wilson, you know, Bill was a finance guy from New York, had proposed this thing to John D. Rockefeller, in the hopes of maybe getting John D. to finance this venture with millions of dollars, I suppose, or substantial finances. This is, I think, when John D. said to Bill, but wouldn't money ruin this thing? That he must have meant that with mixed emotion, don't you think?
Well, you know, he meant it right.
Yeah,
he meant it right.
Yeah, well, thank God we didn't get that thing, the money there on that thing. But in any event, our society then entered a fearsome and exciting adolescent period. The test that it faced was this. Could these large numbers of erstwhile, erratic alcoholics successfully meet and work together? Would there be quarrels over membership, leadership, and money? Would there be strivings for power and prestige? Would there be schisms which would split AA apart? Soon AA was beset by these problems on every side and in every group. But out of this frightening and at first disrupting experience, the conviction grew that AAs had to hang together or die separately. We had to unify our fellowship or pass off the scene. Why don't you take over from there?
I will. You know, that as we're reading that is just so important to why AA is still here. And if you look at the first tradition, this is, Alcoholics Anonymous was founded in 1939. The traditions were not written until 1953. And if you've ever met someone, which I did, who was sober before there were traditions. Just imagine this group of lunatics with no rules whatsoever. And that's really what was happening. It was Eddie Dalton, God rest his soul, and he would talk about the anarchy and the lunacy and the fighting. I mean, here we have suggestions, traditions, and there's still all of those things, but there's, you know, there's an ultimate authority in here. And you know, if you have a problem with God, deal with it. Because, you know, if God scares you out of this room, booze and drugs is going to scare you back. And that's just the way it is. So, you know, we don't ever apologize for talking about God. It says that in here. But this is so important, especially in this day and age, where they think we need publicity. I mean, you know, the first tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous says, as our common welfare should come first, that we need to remain together, and as long as the ties that tie us together are stronger than those that would break us apart, all will be well. And back then, before traditions, and even with Bill, you know, wanting the money, and he was like a power broker guy, God was involved then. Because through the Rockefellers, who I don't know how he came to this decision, just like I don't know how this whole thing happened, because that's what God is. He's limitless. He's abundant. He does things that you can't conceive of. Okay, I mean, you could be looking out, and everything in my life, I mean, I look at my life today, not humanly possible. And I keep saying that because I know that some power greater than me dealt these cards out. By the grace of God, I'm here today. Just in case I didn't say it, I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. My name's Paul E. And, see, I have these flashback memories, a lot of mental hospitals. And right there, it was like, it was one of those Creedmoor State Hospitals. I was rocking back. And I realized it was almost medication time. Anyway, if you're new or you're coming back, welcome home. You're off the hook. And that was what was told to me a long time ago, and it's proven to be the case. You don't need to pick up no matter what. And, you know, we're in a protected, safe place right here. We don't care what you did, who you did it with, how you did it. We don't care how low you went. Because you can get off this elevator any way you want and start heading back up. So, you know, we're glad you're here, and I'm going to give it to the senior, or not the senior, the junior member. You heard that last week.
You know, the miracle, God was really working in this deal in 1940 with John D. Rockefeller. Just, I know we have a lot of people with long-term sobriety in here in their 20s and 30s and things like that. And, you know, I've sponsored a bunch of guys. I know Paul has, too. And as they say in the 12 and 12, I don't want to deprecate. The last thing I want to do is deprecate material achievement, you know, or anything like that, or put it down. But if you sponsor alcoholics, a substantial number of alcoholics, and I'm not going to take a poll on this, I can't tell you how many guys I know have gotten in here and after the first 3 years or 2 years have gone sideways and out and been diverted because they came into substantial wealth or money or good stuff start happening to them. As a matter of fact, although I can't prove this, I almost want to think that the harder the times are materially for alcoholics, the better chance they have of staying sober, getting seriously sober. There's something about an alcoholic suffering a lot of trials and tribulations and really kept down on his knees, maybe having something to do with our ego or vanity or something like that, that really forced them to go to the rooms and struggle like their life is over on a daily basis, hugging on to God, hugging on to anything because they got nothing else going on. They got no girlfriend, they got no boyfriend, they don't got the car, they don't got the money. All they got is some AA room and a bunch of buddies. There's something about that going through that deal over a period of months and years that somehow gives you tenfold strength, serious strength as an alcoholic. And I can't tell you how many guys have did the, don't worry about me, I'm not going to drink. And all of a sudden they got the Maserati. And they still got the job, and they get the wife, and they get back in the big bed, and it's adios muchacho. So when you get a guy like John D. Rockefeller, who has millions, you know, he could have split Bill Wilson $100,000 like I give like a couple of dollars to the guy at the corner, and he's enamored with Bill Wilson. He likes the guy. He's inviting people over to listen. He thinks there's really something here. When you think about it, the easiest thing in the world would have been for John D. Rockefeller. I mean, it's like amazing. He was giving money all he had foundations for him to say, well, here's $20,000, here's $30,000. I mean, how many guys have read Bill's story about him stealing money from his wife? So Bill's story, you know, Bill Wilson, you know who we're talking about. The guy who was suffering from waves of, you know, self, you know, pity and all that sort of stuff, had to go to the hospital. He was nuts. He was in the chips. He was wearing the coat of green or whatever. That guy, you know what I mean? How long do you think he would have been around in Alcoholics Anonymous, and therefore you'd be around, if John D. Rockefeller said, you know, here's $5,000, put $5,000 in his hand? I mean, listen, we'd all be drinking today. What could have possessed this guy? It had to be a miracle to look at Bill Wilson after inviting him to an old thing. He says, I think money would ruin this thing. I mean, I don't even think they invented Al-Anon at that time, so it could have been some Al-Anon, you know. I mean, the guy looks at him and says, I'm not going to give you any money. Because money would kill. How did he know that money would kill this thing? It's just amazing. There's so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous who are alcoholics. They even say it in the 12th step, should we give money to alcoholics? He says, when we start giving them money, they start relying on us instead of God. How would he? That's what it says right in our 12th step. It tells us that. There is time and place to give money, but when we give money and things, because all alcoholics do, like Bill Wilson, is cry out for money and things. But you give money, they'll rely on you instead of God. And the whole key is job or no job nonsense. They got to rely on God before you. How did John D. Rockefeller know? He just come on this thing that the worst thing in the world would be to flip this guy $1,000 or $2,000 or $3,000 and not do it. You know, I mean, I think it's a miracle right there that that didn't happen. So that's all I have to say about that deal.
That was pretty insightful, actually.
Oh, my God. That's amazing. Are you sober?
I must be in a good place then. No, you know, that was really deep. Not to say that you need to take a vow of poverty when you come into Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? Because that's what I guess we could have heard. But I remember I sponsored this guy. His nickname was Boca Joe, God rest his soul. He died sober. And the reason his nickname was Boca Joe is because he owned Boca Raton. I mean, he built Escondido, Boca West. He had enormous money. There's two guys in there that know him pretty well. And he always said, thank God I didn't have to take a vow of poverty when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. He had the deal, and he had the desperation, which is what it takes. See, and we've all seen it. I know a couple of people, as we speak, that got very big. Of course, looking around this room, I don't think that's a problem. As Russell was saying, I'm looking around here. I don't think the basket's going to be covered here in this room tonight. But, you know, you come in here and you start getting your brains back a little bit, and you start showing up for work, and some people get pretty lucky. You show up for work, somehow you get paid, and you don't drink and you don't use. You get paid more, you have more, and it happens. And sometimes, too often, that becomes the answer after you're here a little bit of a time. And as he said, you get the woman back, you get the car, you get the house, and then you know what? I don't really have to go tonight. Because my wife's going to cook dinner. And I haven't had a cooked dinner in a very long time. I haven't had a wife in a very long time, so maybe. So then you stay home that night. You still feel great. You had a beautiful night. You go to work. And then you do the same thing 3 days later, 5 days later. And then you know what? This becomes less important. And it was told to me from day one. Anything I put in front of my sobriety, I'm done. I'm going to lose whatever it is I put in front of it, and then I'm also probably going to lose my sobriety. And we've seen it over and over and over and over again. And this is a gift. And unless you realize not only that it's a gift, that you've been touched, that you've been chosen, whatever words you want to use, but the responsibility, once you've been given this, is to find someone to give it to. I don't care if you've got 3 days sober, and this may or may not be in here, I don't care, because I'm not here to placate anyone. I'm here to tell you what I did. And I was blessed to get sober and clean when another fellowship was just beginning, and there was nobody there. So anybody who had a week clean and sober was sponsorship material, because I was doing something for a week that you couldn't. So I had that 1 week to share with you in my raving lunacy how this happens. I mean, you got to understand that. I'm just going to say this and then we'll go to the next paragraph. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I know this is going to be difficult to imagine. I was 145 pounds. But you knew me back then larger than life. And you too. Anyway, I was 145 pounds. And I'm 6'1 and change. And I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is the way I looked. I was wearing a three-piece blue, powder blue suit. I was wearing one of these Huggy Bear, this is 1980, Huggy Bear flowered yellow shirts with prints on it. I was wearing a pimp hat, and I was carrying an attaché case. And I had the walk. And I walked into the 101 Club. And thank God, Jim Sullivan, who's still sober and alive, he lives in Jacksonville, and he was at the door. And he stopped me, and he goes, yo. He's a very good friend of mine. He says, we can see that you have the answers. It's obvious. The way you're walking, the way you're dressed, just everything about you. But do us a favor. Leave your brains on the door when you walk in here. This thing's been working fine for 50 years before you got here. It's going to work great once you leave here. Come in here if you want to learn a little and just shut up. Now, they don't say that anymore because it's not conducive, I don't know, to insurance payments or something. But the fact of the matter is, Fred's busy and Ray didn't care about my insurance payment. They wanted to save my ass, and by the grace of God, with God's help and their leadership, they gave me stuff that I, no matter how much I give away, no matter how much, it brings me tears of joy. No matter how much I give, how could you possibly pay? I was dead in 1976. I was pronounced dead in a coma. I come here in 1980, and I meet a few people, and I've had a 34-year ride. And it's not been straight up. There's been really some terrible, tragic stuff in that 34 years. But you know what? Even the tragic stuff, God sees the whole picture. We only see the little piece of the mosaic, and that's where faith comes in. You got to trust the process. Believe it. I believe. Just believe everything is for the good. Everything. No matter how terrible it seems. Your wife ran off with your best friend. You got invited. Your firm went out of business. They repossessed your Maserati. And you have a sexually transmitted disease. But you're sober. And you know what? God knows what he's doing. Anyway, you got to count your blessings. That's the secret to this.
Was that powder blue?
I don't know. It's in the book.
I'm trying to lose the image of the powder blue suit. Was that polyester?
I still have it.
What did you have in the attaché case?
Yeah, I'll show you that one day.
Okay, well, I'm going to page 11, getting on this material thing again. This is Bill Wilson's story, talking about what he would have done with the money. What do you think he would have done with the money? This is page 12. For a brief moment, I needed and wanted God. This is when he was desperate. There had been a humble willingness to have him with me, and he came. But soon, the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself, and so it had been ever since. How blind I had been. Now, what do you think he was talking about when he said worldly clamors? What do you think he's talking about? Was it money, power, prestige, the gals, all the things that divert us still from this deal? You know, I got to tell you something. I'm sponsoring somebody, and he calls me up and says he can't make a meeting, or he can't do this, or he can't do that. It's always because of something going on in the world that all of a sudden he thinks he owes more allegiance to, you know, that he idolizes. He thinks it's more important than focusing on God and the work that God would have him be. And I'll remind you that in our big book on page 63, it says being all powerful, he gives us everything we need as long as there's a condition to that, as long as we stay close to him and we perform his work well. So he gives us all power to withstand anything as long as we stay close to him, which means I guess you better know who he is. You better figure that thing out, and you better figure out what the work is that you need to perform. And I can promise you this, from working with a lot of alcoholics and dealing with them, most alcoholics, when they're talking to me about the complaints they have and the things they think they got to do, have absolutely nothing to do with the work he wants them to perform. It has to do with the work that they want to perform in their life, that they think is important. And usually it's the same kind of crap that they were thinking about before they even came into Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the same agenda. It's the same deal. They just want to do it sober over a cup of coffee. You understand what I'm saying? Yeah. So that's the deal. So it's let's read on. I think we... Where are we now? As we discover the principles by which?
You know the sad thing, Russell?
What?
I think that this is the 11 months I came before you when they were giving the information out. Because I have a different book than you.
You did.
And this, I think, may be the one with the
You have that NA book? You know,
no.
Russell
came to my home.
I know you have 34 years, but part of that is NA, and I tell you that's really...
Easy. Why don't you read it, because we're up to your place, and I'll figure it out.
As we discovered the principles... Did I hear a hiss? Was that a hiss? Okay. As we discovered the principles by which the individual alcohol could live, we had to evolve principles by which the A groups and A as a whole could survive and function effectively. It was thought that no alcoholic man or woman could be excluded from our society that our leaders might serve but never govern, that each group was to be autonomous and there was to be no professional class of therapy, there were to be no fees or dues, our expenses were to be met by our own voluntary contributions, there was to be at least be the least possible organization, no problem there. Even in our service centers, our public relations were to be based upon attraction rather than promotion. It was decided that all members were to be anonymous at the level of press, radio, TV, and films. I think it was Dr. Bob who said he thought that we carried that a little bit too far when we were talking about being anonymous in our groups, ourselves, between each other. It was decided that all members ought to be anonymous at the level of press, radio, TV, and films, and in no circumstances should we give endorsements, make alliances, or enter public controversies. Of course, he's talking about the tradition. You have anything you want to say about that paragraph?
Yeah.
Probably. Okay.
You know, the key is that, and actually when it said that, you realize, and if you really read this book and you study it, and I've done it, I've never studied anything in my whole life, but when I realized I was here and I wanted to stay here, I wanted to learn about what was here. And I really, to this day, I read this book and I read the book, reread the book, because there's so much information here. And right here, that paragraph we just read, it talked about you can't professionalize Alcoholics Anonymous. It said it right here. It said in black and white that the therapeutic value of one alcoholic helping another, that's the answer. And as we said last week, you know, Bill Wilson got sober in November of 1934. How come Alcoholics Anonymous' birthday is June of 1935? Because that's when he met Dr. Bob in Akron, Ohio, and until there were two, there wasn't us. So that's a little bit of how this thing happened. And the way it continues to happen is by listening to the people that came before. And I just thank God, there's not a day that goes by, I swear not a day goes by, I don't talk about Fred T. or I don't talk about Ray Allen to somebody somewhere, because for 25 years of my sobriety, they were there every day, every minute, every hour, through every crisis. I remember when the government, I had almost 2 years sober, and the United States government decided that I was no longer eligible for disability payments. Now, I got very angry about that because the first 2 years, I was like a paid member of Alcoholics Anonymous. They were sending me my money. I would go to 5 meetings a day, and they didn't even give me a disability detox. They just removed it, and I was petrified. And I went running to Ray's house. He lived at Imperial Point, and I was petrified. And he looked at me with his little blue eyes, and he says, "You were getting a lot of money from the government, right?" He says, "Why?" I said, "Well, because you know, when I was drinking and using, I made a lot of money, and that's the way they paid me, because I was a mental patient, and I was never going to work again." And he says, "And now you don't drink, and you don't take drugs, right?" I said, "That's right." So he thought, he looked, and he thought for a minute, and he says, "Well, you know what I'd like you to do? Go to the Eckerd's drugstore on the corner and buy the Sun Sentinel. Because in the back of the Sun Sentinel, they have want ads. Now leave my house." And he threw me out of the house. He says, "Get a job. What's so difficult? Get a job." So anyway, it's a process. And I'm so grateful for every trial and tribulation that happened. And some real terrible things. So what? If you drink or you use, there's a lot more terrible things. So, go ahead, Russell.
Okay, this foreword was written, I think, 20 years. It was written in 1955. AA started in 1935. So this foreword was written 20 years after AA started. Bill met Bob. That's important because we're getting to some statistics in a second. Okay, this was the previous paragraph I read. It says, this was the substance of AA's 12 traditions, which are stated in full on page 564 of this book. So none of these principles had the force of rules of law, they had become so widely accepted by 1950 that they were confirmed by our first international conference held at Cleveland. Today, the remarkable unity of AA is one of the greatest assets that our society has. which is incredible, which is true, while the internal difficulties of our adolescent period were being ironed out, public acceptance of AIDS grew by leaps and bounds. For this, there were two principal reasons. One, the large number of recoveries and reunited homes, and two, these made impressions everywhere of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried. Now, here's the statistics. I want you to listen to this. And I'm just going to lay it out for you. I'm not going to go into, you know, I have my own opinions, which I am not going to express to you now today. If you've been to my step series, you know I have opinions. And you want to know something? I'll even make this admission. I could be wrong. I have an idea. I've read some things as far as the statistics today. They could be wrong. They could be right. You'll make your own judgment regarding that as concerned. But these were the statistics early on. Of the alcoholics who came today and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. In other words, one out of two got sober and never drank again. One out of two got sober and never slipped and never drank again. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder got sobered up after some relapses, another 25%, which makes it 75%, had a few slips and then never drank again. So that 75% of the people came in and stopped drinking, either immediately never drank again, or had a few slips and then never drank again. 75%. Among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. Other thousands came to a few AA meetings and at first decided they didn't want the program. A great number of these, about two out of three, began to return as time passed. So these people, if you believe these statistics, is they're saying pretty much approximately 75% of people that came to AA got sober and stayed sober. Now, I'm just going to suggest this to you. I could be wrong. I've been around for a while. It's not that high today. AA is all over the place. The big book is published all over the place. We got the traditions. We got the steps. We got step meetings. It's more prevalent than anywhere. We got a huge volume. It's not that high today. It's slightly, it's substantially. Listen, one of the statistics I heard, as a matter of fact, if somebody sends me their email, I'll dig up the paper that was written, where it comes from, is that 0.5%, 1 in 200, stay sober for more than 20 years. Now, that's controversial. You could say that's crazy. But I think that most people that have sponsored people been around for 20, 30 years, you know, understand and would agree that it's probably closer to that lower amount than the 75% amount. You know, there are people dying. Now, that could be because they're coming in with a higher bottom, or what? It could be some people argue that we're not really the same program we used to be, a little bit of a different program. You could read Dr. Bob and Good Old Timers as to how they did this thing the first 4, 5, 10, or 15 years, and what they were focused on and what's going on today, whether we're really doing the same exact deal, or the fellowship sites, the demographic. I don't know. But the bottom line is, what I just read was a very, very large percentage of people that came in stayed sober, and I'm not sure that's the way it is today. And you can make your own judgment. As time goes on, as you stay sober, you'll make your own judgment as to, you know, why that is and what the deal is for that. You got anything to say about that?
No, I'm going to read for a bit.
Okay.
Like when Bill Wilson used to speak, they called it the bedtime story.
Right.
I'm going to read. Another reason for the wide acceptance of AA was the ministration of friends in medicine, religion, and the press, together with innumerable others who became our able and persistent advocates. Without such support, AA could have made only the slowest progress. Some of the recommendations of AA's early medical and religious friends is found further on in this book. And Alcoholics Anonymous is not a religious organization. Neither does AA take any particular medical point of view, though we cooperate widely with the men of medicine as well as the men of religion. Because alcohol is no respecter of persons. We're an accurate, just look around the room, cross-section of America. And in distant lands, the same democratic evening-up process is now going on. By personal religious affiliation, we include Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Hindus, a sprinkling of Muslims and Buddhists. More than 15% of us are women. today that's probably 30%. I don't know, but it seems like a lot to me. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I married half of them. At present, our membership is pyramiding at the rate of 20% a year. That's incredible. And so far, upon the total problem of 7 million actual and potential alcoholics in the world, we've made only a scratch. In all probability, we'll never be able to touch more than a fair fraction of the alcohol problem in all its ramifications. Upon therapy for the alcoholic himself, we surely have no monopoly. Yet it's our great hope that all those who have as yet found no answer may begin to find one in the pages of this book and will presently join us on the high road to a new freedom. And the amazing thing is, the name of my first home group was the New Freedom Group. Okay, and I never even saw that. So every time I read this, something new happens to me. Okay, and I was thinking about this last night. Alcoholics Anonymous, they don't know how many, how could you know how many people are in it? It's an anonymous program. But it's a lot, okay? And so there's probably millions of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. This was put together in 1939. This is 2014. There are now 100, listen carefully, 100 12-step programs taken from these 12 steps. So if you don't think this was a wholesale miracle, incomprehensible what God did in 1935 with Bill Wilson, and then has created from that these two guys, the 12 guys, to 1,000, to 10,000, I mean, the most incredible pyramid scheme in the world, and they put this together. This is multi-level marketing on steroids, what we have here. And the incredible thing is, and if you Google the 12-step programs, I mean, I have done this, and I qualify for everyone. No, except one. I mean, it's Narcotics Anonymous, it's Love Anonymous, Sex and Love, pot smoking, cocaine. I mean, every day, amazing stuff they have. Shoplifters Anonymous, Emotions Anonymous, Depressions Anonymous. I mean, seriously, you Google it, you see, I'm not kidding. There's one that I don't qualify for. Called Lip Balm Anonymous. No, I swear to God. They have meetings in New York City. I punched them up. Now, I can't possibly imagine if my bottom was lip balm. I would have ended up in Eckerd's with, like, these trench coats, taking pink and blue. But there's people, I mean, I shouldn't laugh, because if I ever went to one of those meetings, that lip balm is making your life unmanageable. I hid it in the toilet and my husband found it. Anyway, so I was thinking about that.
So in any event, while you're telling them, while you're reading from the book and telling them that at present our membership is pyramiding at the rate of 20% per year, I'm reading the same page 20, and it says at present our membership is increasing at the rate of 7% per year, which means one of us is reading from a bogus book. Either that or never trust anything written by alcoholics. I don't know. We'll try to get some fun with that. Remember, our book sort of differs somehow.
Yeah, well, I told you.
You know, they didn't like you. They gave you the wrong book.
Problem.
I don't know.
Problem.
So we're going to go on to forward to the third edition. What do you think?
Let's do that.
Let's hope we have
the only book. One other thing is, just so you understand, in that conference in 1955, it was where this guy, Dr. Henry Thibault, I mean, think about this. He gave a talk at that conference. And his purpose in life, he was a psychiatrist. His purpose in life was studying the ego in the alcoholic. That was his whole purpose. I mean, the guy went to medical school, doctor's school, college, and he comes out. Imagine what his parents thought. So what are you going to do, Bill? Well, I'll tell you what. I decided I'm going to study the ego in the alcoholic. And this is what he spent his whole life doing. And it was one of the greatest things that ever happened to alcoholics. And if you ever stay here a little bit of time and you read AA Comes of Age, there's a whole section on him and what he did. And that was at the 1956 conference, 55 conference in New York City. So here's the forward to the third edition. We're just squirreling right along here.
Yeah, let's get to the doctor.
It's amazing.
Here. Let's keep on going. Let's
you know what? By June, we'll finish this fourth edition. By March of 1976, when this edition went to the printer, the total, think about this, the total worldwide membership was conservatively estimated at more than 1 million. So that's 1976. In 1939, it was 100. Because it said we're a group of 100 men and women. So now it's 1 million 40 years later, 37 years later, okay? And with almost 28,000 groups in over 90 countries. Surveys of groups in the United States and Canada indicate that AA is reaching out not only to more and more people, but to a wider and wider range. Women now make more than one-fourth of the membership among newer members, and that's still almost 40 years ago. So that 30% figure I threw out was probably an understatement. It's probably more than that right now. And 7%, this is where you got your 7%, you were like an attorney reading between the lines. 7% of the AA surveyed are less than 30 years of age. Among them, many in their teens. And the basic principles of the AA program, it appears, hold good for individuals with many different lifestyles, just as the program has brought recovery to those of many different nationalities. The 12 steps that summarize the program may be called Les Doce Pasos in one country, Les Douze Tap in another, but they trace exactly, I like it, Les Douze Tap. Did I do that good to my Canadians? I guess I got people come down from Montreal to hear this. So they give me the Les Douze Tap. In another, but they trace exactly the same path to recovery that was blazed by the earliest members of Alcoholics Anonymous. In spite of the great increase in the size and the span of this fellowship, at its core, it remains simple and personal. Each day is incredible. Each day, somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks with another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. And that's never changed. That was from day one, Bill and Bob, to day whatever you were late. What do you have to say, Russell?
Well, I'm so wanting to get into the letter.
Yeah, but we're probably going to wait until next week when I come back.
Oh, because, okay, so we're going to do okay.
Well,
so,
maybe, but I think we could spend a half hour on this 12th.
Well, you know, with if you say anything about this, it's going to be basically about one alcoholic talking to another. Because my experience, you know, my first sponsor, I've had three sponsors. You know, people say, well, you've been my temporary sponsor. I said, I don't know how to make it permanent because my first two sponsors died of cancer. You know, and I, you know, we just, that's what happens. You stay in here long enough, you know, and, you know, people die and they leave you and everything like that. My sponsors have all been wonderful, incredible men, plus the mentors I've had have been incredible. But they've all had something, my sponsors had many things in common. It's interesting. They have many things in common. And one of the things they had in common was this incredible desire to disciple people and carry the message. It was like Bill Wilson said in the chapter Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease that I have to keep talking about it and telling other people. You know, sometimes when you first get into Alcoholics Anonymous, you get excited about it and you go and talk to your family and they slap you down and you say they don't understand. You talk to a few people because you're excited, but then that sort of fades. But with some of us and the people that I look up to and the people that mentored me, that desire to talk about it and carry the message becomes your entire way of life. That becomes really, that is when I was talking about stay close to him and perform the work, his work is really to help and minister to other alcoholics. That's his work. And for many people, the ones that at least I look up to and that were my mentors and my sponsors, every one of them, the one thing you could tell that was characteristically in common is that they loved people and they couldn't wait to try to help other people. It became their entire life You know, and I say this sometimes as a step means because it's the truth, and I don't know how to explain it except, you know, the great thing about testimonies, you don't have to explain it in experience. There was a point in time in my sobriety where I went to meetings because I needed a meeting. Now, I'm not saying I don't need meetings. I need meetings, okay? But I went to meetings with an avid understanding that I needed a meeting. Sometimes I would even say, you ever say this? I need a meeting. You know, almost like the way I used to say, I need a drink. Look, when I said I needed a drink, I don't know how normal people say I need a drink, or even if they say that, but when I said I needed a drink, I wasn't fooling around. I needed a drink, like now, get out of my way, I'd tell my wife for a drink. You know, I need a drink. And well, sure, you're laughing, you don't know what it's like, but the bottom line is, so when I would say I need a meeting, I needed a meeting. I had to have a meeting, and so I went to a meeting to take and to get and to feel better because I needed a meeting. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that. You know something? That's an AA fact of life. That's a deal you deal with. I don't want to say when you're not mature, but that's something that happens early on. It may last for 10 years. For 10 years, 15 years, you may be going to meetings because you need a meeting or because you have to have a meeting. But at some point in time with me, I don't know what this is like, and I'm just going to tell you, I started going to meetings, not because I needed a meeting, but because to see whether there was anybody there I could help. I don't know how to explain it. I don't know whether anybody else had that experience. You went to meetings not because you were falling apart or going crazy. As a matter of fact, those promises were working sort of permanently in your life. You had a feeling of ease and comfort. You know, you started, just like it says in the book, you lost concern over your the details of your life and the plans and designs. You started having concern for others. Exactly what they say on page 63 started happening to me. That started happening to me. And all of a sudden I found myself going to meetings to see what was happening in the meetings, to see if there were newcomers or other people there, to see if there's anything I can contribute to help other people. It was a desire to help other people. And here's the crazy thing. I started going, because of my desire to share what had happened to me, I was actually going to more meetings. It became a greater part of my life than the meetings I was going to because I just needed a meeting. Does that make any sense? I would be going early on to meetings because I needed a meeting, and maybe I'd go to 3 or 4 meetings a week or 5 meetings a week. When I started going to meetings because I wanted to see if there was anybody I could help, I was going to 7 to 10 and looking for the next one. And it may not even be a meeting. It might be a Bible study. Maybe somebody, maybe out on the street. It may be a guy I just run into and say, how you doing? I was just looking for people that I could somehow share hope with to lift them from lives of quiet desperation. Because that's the miracle. That's what happens when you go from a life of death, where you're just going home to work, home to work, home to work, living lives of quiet desperation, to a life of hope where you feel like you have a purpose in life. And you're excited, and that has nothing to do with the money. It has to do with trying to share his message, the message that there is hope. And you want to know something? I got to tell you something. You don't have to have a chip in your pocket to be my friend. You don't have to be an alcoholic for me to sit down and try to help you and talk to you because you want something. I found that 90% of the people that are desperate and lonely and hungry for love out there and that are hurting, you want something? They may not be alcoholics.
There you go.
You know, they're suffering from the same crap that you hear about in our meetings. The same stuff that's going on with us, they're suffering from. You know what? They just don't drink. They just sit around feeling sorry for themselves and living lives of quiet desperation, sitting around in life and loneliness. And they're just going through a real hard, they just don't drink. Unfortunately, they don't have any meetings to go to. They don't got any meetings to go to. All they got is us. So that's the only thing I have to say about that. I don't know if you got anything you want to...
That was pretty bad. I hear the pastor getting ready. I'm going to see if I can get him out of his chair.
Okay.
Let me just say one thing here because I forgot, and it's sad. You know, I don't know if I told you last week, my cat was very sick, and it was my wife's cat for 14 years, and I was having breathing problems and cancer, and I was up there, and they drained the fluid, et cetera. Anyway, we put her to sleep yesterday. And, you know, it's a really great cat. Some people don't get it, and some people do. And if you get it, great. And if you don't, that's cool, too. But anyway, I have to fly up tomorrow morning, you know, just to be with my wife. And then, thank God, it's such a big group because I had to spend a lot of money on the airline ticket. And I'm flying back next Thursday so I can be here. So I'm just letting you know, it's a last-minute thing, so dig deep when the basket goes in. But
there are no dues or fees, but we do take
somehow, care. Come on.
You know,
I mean, really, I didn't need it. I'm eating tonight. Okay?
Right.
Russell may have. I didn't. Anyway, No, no, he said something so important because it's such a big part of what has kept me coming here. And he spoke about purpose. And I'm going to tell you flat out, early on in my sobriety, I read a book. And it was called Man's Search for Meaning. And it was written by a psychiatrist, Holocaust survivor, named Dr. Viktor Frankl. And here, it's a little book. I mean, it's a little paperback book. And here's the story in it that I would like to exemplify, if I could, in my life. Because these are like his mentors, the same mentors. The people that had what I want. Yeah, well, you want what we have, you do what we do. If you don't want it, don't worry about it. You got no chance of getting it. So I read this book, and here's what it says. He's in a concentration camp, and he's watching all the horrors and, you know, terrible things. There's 6 million people killed. But because he was a psychiatrist, they kept him alive because they needed his services. He was a doctor, a psychiatrist, and he watched all his friends die. And then he finally got out without going to the ovens. And he came back, and he spent the next year or two of his life traveling to college campuses around the world. And he just wanted to know a couple of things. And so the main thing he really wanted to know is, what are you doing here? So he went to all of these college kids, thousands upon thousands of people, and he says, so why are you here? I mean, what do you want out of this? And I'm going to sort of make up the numbers, but they're pretty close, okay? I mean, you'll get the idea. Basically, 60 or 70% of the people interviewed said, well, I'm here because I want to find my soulmate. And I want to, you know, hopefully find that love of my life and we'll be able to live happily ever after. We'll have a couple of kids, et cetera, et cetera. 10 or 15% of the people there said, well, I'd like to learn something here or do something here that will create something that will change the world. You know, find something real dramatic. The people that wanted to find their soulmate was only 10 or 15%. The 70% remaining, I haven't read it in a while, I have to read it. The 70% remaining, when asked, well, what do you want to do here? They simply said, I want to find my purpose for life. I.e. the title, Man's Search for Meaning. Let me tell you something. No matter how much money you have, no matter where you come from, no matter who you are, no matter who your family is, when it's all said and done, everybody wants to know, why are we here? And the greatest news is, and if you jump into this thing, you'll realize it every morning that you get up. Our purpose is given to us every single day that we're at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. What is our purpose? To stay sober and try to help the next bozo on the bus. That's why we're here. That's the deal, no more and no less. That's why I jump out of bed every morning, 6 a.m., every morning. You know why? Because I did a survey. 95% of everyone who dies lying down. So I'm 6 in the morning. I'm up and about. Let's get this party started.
They asked Mother Teresa one time, a New York Times reporter reportedly asked her, she was following around the slums, and after he saw what she did with all the work she did, he said, you know, I wouldn't do what you do for $1 million. And she said, neither would I.
Right.
And let me tell you, here's the bottom line, okay? A worldly purpose will never assure you or keep you sober. And when I say sober, I mean not only physically sober, but emotionally sober. A worldly, only a divine purpose, a godly purpose will keep you sober. There's a reason why people you read in the newspaper who are incredibly talented actors or musicians or whatever, or have all the money in the world that you're absolutely sure if you had, you'd be sober forever. Have all the stuff, all the Ferraris, you know, which you'd say, well, if I had that, I'd certainly be happy. There's a reason why you are watching people destroy themselves with everything you think if you had, you'd be okay. And the reason is because even with all the talent and all the money and all the everything, they haven't found the godly purpose. It's all worldly purpose. And you know something? It's like it says, I hate to say this, I'm going to say it in the book of Ecclesiastes, written 5,000 years ago. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. All this stuff that he had, King Solomon, what he basically says in the book, it says none of it satisfied him. All the palaces, all the women, in the end, it was all ashes in his mouth. It was all about serving God. And you know, if you're given this deal, you're given a godly purpose. I mean, there's no question about it. It says your maximum service is to God and other people. It's not to acquire money or wealth. It may happen. You don't necessarily have to lose it all. You could be wealthy. But the bottom line is, if you feel you have a purpose that's divine and inspired, and you feel in your heart that you're really helping people, it's amazing how it'll get you to go to meetings. It's amazing how you will feel good about yourself, even when you're going through trials and difficulties. And if it's all about the money, and it's all about the women or the men or the sex, let me tell you something, that gets old real fast. And some of you guys were going, and all of us were going for that deal before we got here. By the way, how did that work out for you? You know, same thing happened to me. It didn't work out at all.
Thank you. That was good. Half a slip. You know what? Just be grateful. If you're sitting here, you're here, you're in a safe place. I mean, this is a safe place here. It may not be the last house on the block, but it's the biggest. And once you get here, man, the sky's the limit. It's limitless. I mean, I'll tell you what. I know that I've only scratched the surface. And I just celebrated 34 years in a row by the grace of God. And I know that I've just scratched the surface. How do I know that? Because new things happen to me every day that are incomprehensible, not believable, not humanly possible. So if it's not humanly possible, use your imagination. Anyway, I think we're question and answer time.
I think it's question and answer.
Good.
Another miracle.
Questionnaire, but be questions. You know, like no name, but how long you sober. Like, has there ever been another census or anything taken to substantiate any of these numbers? I mean, I don't.
As far as I know, the answer is no, but I mean, I really don't know. I'll bet you could Google that or something. I've never seen anything.
That's a good question.
I think I filled out the same thing, though, one time.
Wow,
that it? No, not even a burning desire? Oh, no, we don't want to hear those.
No.
No, let's not
talk
about that.
Do you want the questions for you guys? Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. All right, so the waiting is our certification to come up in...
You're wowed into silence.
I'm gonna assume just that's a good thing. I'm assuming that's a good thing.
It's actually not the Secretary of the Board. We're gonna do the anniversaries for this evening. Our group consciousness, we do anniversaries here, and we allow the celebrants to come up, spend a minute or two, talk about what the program got and got in lives. Tonight we have Bruce Best with 3 years.
No.